This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk, and boy, we have a special guest today. His name is Christopher Rice. Yes, he's the son of Anne Rice, and he has a new book out called The Heavens Rise. It's got a beautiful southern cover on it. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just fine. I could just stare at this cover for hours.
Isn't it gorgeous? And I don't know, so you're handling an actual hardcover copy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's soft. I don't know what it is about it. It's like the quality of the paper itself is like, it's yummy. That's the only way I can describe it, which is a little weird for a book that, you know, involves such horrifying things.
Well, aren't weirds all weird people? I mean, we're all weird in our own way, you know?
Yeah, no, I like weird. I go for weird, yeah.
I mean, but nobody's normal anymore. It's like, what is normal anymore? You know, you get married, you have two kids, and you settle down for the rest of your life. That's normal?
Yeah, I don't think if that was enough to make you normal, we would have a lot more normal people. I agree with you. I don't really know what normal is anymore. You know, I know people who shoot for normal, but they don't often end up making it.
Right, exactly. Well, this is certainly not a what you would call a normal book. It's a very, very, this is one of the most unusual books I've ever read. Does that bother you when I say that?
No, it doesn't, because I think what it means is, like, I don't, you know, I will call it a supernatural thriller, because I think at essence that's really what it is, but it has an element of realism to it that are there deliberately, and they're supposed to be a little cross-genre, and everything I've written has always been a little cross-genre. It hasn't been, you couldn't categorize it or typecast it quite as easily as you can some other books, and I'm not faulting those other books. I love pure horror novels, I love pure thrillers, I love stuff, but there's always been, on my part at least, I have always attempted to try to give you complex, realistic characters, no matter how extraordinary the circumstances around them are going to become. And I think that describes The Heavens Rise.
Yeah, and they're all unusual characters. I mean, every character in your book is unusual. We meet them, I mean, what's her name, Marissa, the editor, she's somebody that I just want to smack, you know, like, what is the matter with this woman, you know? She's just,
really, Marissa, huh?
I mean,
that's so funny. I was about to say, you're the first person to bring up Marissa, I think, at all, and she's one of my favorite characters. Well,
she's annoying, though, but she's supposed to be annoying.
Is she annoying? You know, I think that she is a character who has actually been forced to make a lot of sacrifices for what she believes in. And as the book goes on, you know, I think you meet her and you think she's just going to be the foil. What you really think is she's just going to be like the magical black woman of the piece, that sort of racist cliche in a lot of books about the South. And I was very determined not to make her that. In some ways, her story is the anti-help. You know, she's a highly educated, highly accomplished black woman in an environment where a lot of her fellow, black residents of New Orleans have been held back by lack of resources and bad public education. And so she's an exceptional person, particularly in light of her community that she came from. And she is a mentor to one of the main characters, Ben Broyard, who is a young, privileged white boy from uptown. And she makes it pretty clear that she will mentor him, but she's not his maid. And she's not going to, you know, smooth the road for him when he doesn't need it smooth. So, you know, and a part of her and part of the creation of her was, I wanted, you know, I wrote my first book, A Density of Souls, which was a thriller set in New Orleans, and there wasn't a single black character in it. And when I looked at that later, I thought this was a book that was trying to be about this city, and in some senses it is about the city. And the city at the time when I wrote it was 80% African American, and not a single black character in that novel. So I thought there was no way I could write a book about pre and post Katrina New Orleans and not have not a token black character either, but a fully realized, complicated member of the ensemble who was black and from one of the communities of the Lower Ninth Ward.
Right. And this book goes back and forth between, I think, 2005 and 2013, so two different years we're going back and forth. So we have to keep track of what's happening in each time frame, which is very interesting the way you do it. And you know what it is? Whenever I read a book like that, I always like one time frame over the other. I always find myself wishing it would stay in one time period. Is that weird?
Right. No, I think that's the challenge of it, right? And I think the same is true of multiple points of view. I think there's some dominant points of view in this one, but you know, you have books like, say, The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen comes to mind, where it was like five equal points of view. You fall in love with one, and you may not fall in love with any of the others, you know?
Right, and that's the thing. It's also true when a writer writes a different series of books. You like one series more than the other. You can't help it. It always ends up, I mean, except for like, I'm trying to think of an example. Maybe like Robert Parker. There's a couple different of his series that I enjoyed, but and then you get the third or fourth series, and you're like, oh, I don't like this as much. I want to go back to the other one. Go back to what I know, what I'm familiar with. I think familiarity is very important to the reader. They want to feel like they know the characters.
Well, yeah, and I think another definition of that or another take on that is accessibility, which doesn't necessarily mean stupidity or simplicity, but it's a character that feels accessible to them, but that they can relate to as well. But a lot of times they can relate because the character is accessible and because the writing style illuminates who they are, you know, maybe by going beyond just their behavior and into their interior thoughts and their reactions to the events that are happening around them.
Now, do you know characters like this in real life? Do you know people like this, these characters in this book? I'm fascinated. I mean, are they all in your imagination?
You know, you're from the North? Are you from the Northeast?
I'm from the North, outside of Philly.
It's the Southerners in these characters that's catching you off guard. You know, these are very Southern characters. Anthem Landry, who is the hard-drinking, kind of tough-talking, but big baby, really big softy at heart. Riverboat pilot. He's a very Southern guy, you know, and the same with Ben, and the same with their sort of sharp and sarcastic repartee is very sort of South, or my experience of the South, or at least Louisiana. You know, Louisiana is a very challenging place to live. It's also a very beautiful place to live, and it's a very unique place to live. And there is a laissez-faire attitude about a lot of its weaknesses and its handicaps. And I think it produces this kind of, I don't know, it's not like fast-talking New York sarcasm, but it's a different kind of sarcasm, and maybe irony is a better word for it. And that really defines the way the characters communicate with each other. But these are exceptional characters, and I think that's very much, this is a supernatural thriller about a very unique power that is introduced into this group of friends and this small group of people who've been together over the years. And each one of them has to make a decision about how they're going to embrace it or reject it, and how they will allow it to make them. And so, you know, in light of also the Katrina fallout and the tragedy of that disaster, these are also characters questioning their allegiance to, their loyalty to New Orleans as a city, and their ability to serve New Orleans. You know, in particular, Ben and Marissa, who we've been talking about, are both journalists. And you know, to be a journalist in Louisiana is to be forced to cover a never-ending cycle of political corruption. And I don't necessarily know if it's any worse than, say, Chicago or Los Angeles, where I live now, which was judged to be one of the most politically corrupt cities in America. But in New Orleans, it's so much more out there. You know, there is a French tradition of profiting from political office that is, for the most part, considered un-American or corrupt, as we like to call it. But it has a historical precedent in that part of the country that people sort of get bent out of shape about, but, you know, not really. But as a journalist in that environment, you get sick of it. You know, you're constantly covering stories about unorthodox ties between industries that are damaging communities and the environment and political leaders, and you're constantly encountering this attitude of, oh, well, you know, whatever, you know.
Did you become a writer because of your mother, was she influential in you becoming a writer, or was it just something you've wanted to do all your life?
Well, you know, what I like to say is this, is my primary dream was to be an actor.
Oh, really?
And what they said to me was, and they say it to aspiring writers too, if you can be happy doing anything else, go do that, because this is really tough, and this is a road lined with rejection. And I was told that as a high school theater kid by a very successful alumnus of our high school who'd gone on to have an acting career, Brian Batt, actually. He was on Mad Men for many years, and he came back. And,
oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. No, he's a great guy, and we've become friends since then. But he did say, what they say to you is if you can be happy doing anything else. So I went off to college and was planning to storm the theater department at Brown University when I got there, and the theater department at Brown University was not interested in being stormed. I was not called back for a single audition that I went out on my freshman year. And I was devastated, as only a drama queen can be. But I had been writing all along, and I had vague ideas of writing plays and movies that I would someday be a great big star in. And so instead I just began writing for the sake of writing because, you know, my creative outlet had been taken away, but nobody could get in between me and the computer in my dorm room.
You must have been really depressed at the time, not being able to do what you want to do. I mean,
well,
the acting.
It was very humbling. You know, I'll say that. It was very humbling. I had been the king of the theater department in my high school. I came from a very privileged background. My mother had been very successful. And the answer kind of right when I got to college was no. And it was probably the first time in a while I had heard no. So maybe not necessarily an entirely bad thing. I think some good came out of it. But I began focusing on writing, and I transferred to NYU's Tisch School of the Arts and spent a semester there, and eventually wrote the novel. And nobody was more surprised than myself when I wrote my first novel. It was not in my plans. I thought I would be focused entirely on dramatic writing, like playwrights and screenplays.
It's interesting, though, when there's a connection between, like, you and your mother. When I interview a famous person and they have another famous writer that's a relative, you're always, you know, what do I say? Do I mention that? Or are they going to think that I only became successful because my mother was successful? Obviously, you know how to write.
Well, thank you.
And I'm reading your book, and I'm just getting so involved in it, with these characters. These characters that somehow make me laugh and make me get mad at the same time. I don't know.
Oh, good.
They just kind of do a lot of things to me. And I just feel like saying, they're so sensitive. Some of these characters are very sensitive people.
Yeah.
Are people in the South generally sensitive?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Soulful, I would say, too, but sensitive goes along with that.
Because up here in the North, we're just quiet. Everybody's quiet.
I know. I like to say, I used to do book tours. They would start in the South, and then I would go North. And the two, it was so different, because in the South, it was like family reunion tour, even though they weren't really my family, because everybody's so friendly, and everybody just wants to, it's so exciting that you have a book out. And then you go to the Northeast, and people, like, have opinions about your book.
They do.
And that's where the reviewers live.
I think what I mean by quiet is that people keep to themselves more in the North. You know, it's like there's a fear of other people up here more than there is down South. Down South, it's like, oh, they invite you into their house, they cook for you, you know, up here, it's like, no way that's going to happen unless you know the person. You know, you have to. I live in a community where there's a lot of Indian people and other people, and they don't really have much to do with me. You know, I live by myself. They don't talk all that much to me, and it's kind of a closed society almost.
Well, it makes me a little sad. Yeah, but I mean, if it's what you want, I think it can be great. I think there are people who want to live in that kind of environment, and they would find the South to be overbearing and intrusive.
But I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think a lot of it's their culture. It's just the way they've lived their lives, and that's what they're comfortable with. And I can understand that in a way. But, I mean, I've always been brought up, you know, so you say hello to people, be nice to people.
Right.
Treat them
Absolutely.
With respect and make them feel like they're real people. You know, when I walk by people and they don't talk to me, I get kind of weirded out. I don't know. Maybe it's me. I'm very sensitive, too. So are you a sensitive person, too?
I'm a very sensitive person. That's why my characters are sensitive. I try not to be as sensitive as I was when I was, you know, 15 years old, but I have my moments.
Now, the Heavens Rise. Now, this is your first book in a couple of years, right? When was your last book published?
2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. My last novel was The Moonlit Earth, and it was an international thriller. It was about a young woman whose brother was accused of a hideous act of terrorism, and she, you know, refuses to believe that he's guilty and travels to Hong Kong to find him and prove his innocence. So it was a different book than this. So one of the reasons there was such a lag is because this was my first supernatural thriller, and it didn't start out that way. I had planned to write another, what I call, terrestrial thriller about the world of riverboat pilots in New Orleans. The biggest decision I made at the outset of this book was that I was going to write about New Orleans again, which I had said I would never do because I put the city through such hell in my first novel.
Oh.
And so I didn't plan to make it a supernatural novel until I was exploring these characters in my head and taking notes about them, because I knew it was going to be another group of friends, you know, over the years in Louisiana, and some traumas that had happened along the way that had shaped them. But there was this girl, Nikki DeLongpre, that I kept outlining, and I knew she'd gone missing, but I didn't know why, and I was like, she got a drug problem, and I said, I've really written a lot about characters with drug problems. I don't think I want to go back there. It's another big southern.
You always want to try something new, I would think, as a writer. You want to, you don't want to go through this. I mean, nothing against Danielle Steele, but romance, you know, romance after romance after romance. I mean, doesn't it get old after a while?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of times you can make the case that every writer is just writing the same book over and over again. They're like at its core, they're really telling the same story or an evolving version of the same story. But what I've discovered more and more from talking to writers and meeting other writers and talking to people who work in publishing is that people are usually always writing what they should be writing. You know, that even I'll look at a writer like Danielle Steele or a sort of reliable romance writer, and I think, well, surely she can write something completely different if she's forcing herself to write that. And a lot of times I'm surprised that the answer is really no, that is what comes intuitively to her with each book.
I think it's all, to me, and I can't speak for everybody, but to me it's how the writing speaks to me, how the writing moves me. I want the writing to do something to me. If I sit there and read it in the first 10 pages, I'm bored. I mean, I'm not likely to finish the book.
Right, absolutely. So, the most complimentary thing I think that's been said about this book was by Peter Straub, if I may toot my own horn, and he called it destabilizing, mm-hmm. which is, that's an accurate description of what I set out to do. You know, multiple points of view. I didn't want to go for incoherence or impenetrable, it isn't one plucky detective who takes you through the whole thing and leads you to a neat, tidy conclusion at the end. There's a place for those books, and I enjoy reading them every now and then, but this is a book that is supposed to unnerve you, but also hopefully deliver a very gratifying conclusion.
Right, you have a lot of followers from what I hear, over 100,000. Is that on Facebook?
That is on Facebook, yes. Right. I am an avid Facebooker.
So you do Facebook all the time.
I do it sometimes to the detriment of my daily writing schedule, I have to say, because I'm on Facebook 2 hours into my writing day, and I go, I haven't written a word on my actual book.
Now, do you post a lot of... I always get a kick out of people that post a lot of pictures of their families and stuff, and I think, when I really want myself post... I mean, I don't like looking at pictures of myself. I don't know about anybody else, but I get a kick out of people that just do it. They just throw all these pictures out of themselves and their families, and I'm thinking, that's, you know, they're just throwing everything out there. That stuff, you never know where it's going to end up, you know?
Yeah, I don't post anything on there that I'm not ready for everybody to see. I have a personal profile. I used to have a fan page, but I merged it with a profile a few years ago. And everything I post on it is public, so everybody can see everything that I post. And that's sort of the attitude I've taken with it. I don't understand people who are sort of trying to participate in this great communal environment and then complaining about how everybody's looking at what they post. Like, that's sort of the point, and if you don't want people seeing it, you shouldn't post it on Facebook.
Right.
You know, I'm not really sure how the privacy arguments work once you've opted into this system. But, I like it. It's a great way of organizing your readers in one place. I don't know if I necessarily buy into the belief that it gets you all sorts of new readers. I just think it's a matter of gathering what you have and, you know, letting them know what you're doing. I think for writers it's key because writers have never been very well marketed. You know, that side of the business is not something that the traditional publishers, in my opinion, have been very good at harnessing or being innovative about. It's one of the reasons the recent sort of crisis in the publishing industry has hit so hard, because the primary marketing tool was to send an author to a bookstore. Well, once the bookstores start to close, what do you do? What do you do if there's no, you know, consistent print advertising, if there's no, you know, if all the other ad buys are viewed as too expensive and outside the budget? It's very hard to market the book. So a lot of that's fallen on us. And we've been asked to individually use social media to get the word out and to develop our own community. That's what it's really about. Because as Jennifer Weiner says, and Jennifer Weiner just got sort of slapped by Jonathan Franzen for being such a social media person. And
makes her happy, what's the difference? I mean, why can't we just leave people alone? Let them do what they want. I mean, she's not hurting anybody.
Right. I don't think she is either, and I think Jonathan Franzen is on this kick, that this idea that the written word is being degraded by internet culture. And I, you know, it, for a lot of us, it just looks incredibly disingenuous, because what Jonathan Franzen benefited from was, he is a talented writer. I'm not a huge fan, but I thought there were parts of the corrections that were compelling and interesting.
I love that book. Absolutely love that book.
But he's benefited enormously, as have many authors, by the community that he was educated in, by the friends that he made on the way up, by his personal relationships to the people who have edited magazines, and I'm not really willing to view those connections as somehow more serious or noble than the ones authors acquire on their own through the use of social media. You know, and so, but anyway, the point really that I was trying to make is that Jennifer Weiner says, and I think she's right, that not everybody who follows you wants a constant commercial for your books, but they want to hear your voice. And one of the things she does that's so funny is she live tweets The Bachelorette, which she thinks is a ridiculous show. And she'll go on Twitter and just tweet her thoughts about it.
I agree.
You know, what I did with my best friend, Eric Sharquin, we launched an internet radio show that we streamed through our website, thedinnerpartyshow.com, and it's sort of, it's our voice. It's an attempt to sort of set up a digital storefront, but it's also our voice. It's what we feel about stuff. It's our opinions. It's our thoughts on writing. It's all of it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, I like what you're doing. I like that. I mean, Heaven's Rise is such an interesting book. And there's so much to have a discussion about it. I would love to sit around and listen to what people have, because everybody's got a different opinion about this book. I was reading online on Goodreads, and every review is different.
Interesting.
Very interesting. I was reading them last night, and I'm thinking, wow. You know, and readers just come right out and say what they feel. They don't hold back at all. You know,
right,
especially online.
I have to say, I make a point not to. I slip up every now and then. I try not to go onto Amazon and Goodreads and read reviews, but for a large part because I think it's none of my business. You know, like, I think that's a form for readers to talk to other readers, and I think when authors go on there to eavesdrop, it's never going to go well, in my opinion. I mean, I know other people feel a different way. My mother feels a different way about it. She thinks we're all part of the same conversation, and you know, and that's fine. But you know, I usually find that. What I don't like, I'll tell you point blank what I don't like. I'm not a huge internet anonymity guy. I think that if you're going to express an opinion online, you should be expected to put your actual and real name to it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the sort of anonymous trolling that goes on, it's a problem. You know, and I think various websites are recognizing that it's a problem. Popular Science has taken down their comment sections because they found statistically that people were paying more attention to the BS about science that was being written in the comments than they were to the actual articles. And they said, we have an obligation to actually report science accurately. And if we're putting up this addition to our stories that's full of inaccuracies, we're doing something that's irresponsible. So they took it down.
Well, you know, live a life that's very, I mean, you're very open about your life. I mean, it seems like, you know, I mean, You don't hide things, and you didn't have a. I mean, from what I know, I've heard. I don't know. There was some tragedy when you were a young child.
Well, there was the discovery when I was young that my parents had lost another child before I was born, and I found out about her by accident in class at school. We were making family trees. Actually, it was a unit, you know, the family tree unit, and another kid in class asked a question of the teacher, how do we include a relative who died on our family tree? And we were little kids, so everyone thought that was funny. Oh, is it a dead branch? Is it a dead apple? Oh.
Right.
And the teacher said, that's actually not a funny joke. There are children here in this class, you know, students here who have lost family members, and, you know, Chris lost a sister. And I remember being just flabbergasted. I said, this is the exact quote. I looked at the teacher and said, I most certainly did not. And then I said it again, I most certainly did not. And the class cracked up because the way I said it was so strangely prim and proper.
Right.
But it was the truth. It was the truth. And the teacher knew this because her ex-husband had been a colleague of my father's at San Francisco State University.
I stand right, was, right, yeah.
Yeah, it was really... it was jarring, you know, and I was very young. I understand why they had kept it a secret from me. How do you tell an 8-year-old?
So how did that? How has that affected your life? Has it affected your writing? I mean, is Heaven's Rise, is there anything in the Heaven's Rise where we can see that pain that you were going through?
Well, you know, I think There is always, you know, there was that experience. There was a close friend who committed suicide when I was in high school. I think you can see both of those, that sense that there's a loss or a great loss in early life that needs to be healed in some way later. It's certainly not a concept I came up with. It's very common in fiction, and it's very common in Southern Gothic fiction. But it is definitely present in my work. You know, The Heavens Rise is about, well, it's about a parasite that allows you to control minds, and it has all sorts of supernatural elements in it that reveal themselves over the course of the novel. It's essentially about a group of people trying to grapple with the sudden disappearance of this woman that they loved very much, who was Nikki DeLongpre. And she went missing sort of at this great moment in her life when she was poised to begin adulthood, and boom, she and her entire family were just gone. And that's the human story in it. And so the characters have been grappling with that on top of Katrina and other real-world losses that have afflicted New Orleans since then when we meet them. And so I think they're very much in line with a lot of the characters that I've written about, that sort of struggling with a loss that feels ghostly but bigger than you, you know, because that was what it was like to discover that I had a sister. It was both remote and inaccessible, but also overwhelming, mm-hmm. You know, because, and I remember my parents being very understanding and indulgent of me answering questions about her.
Well, how old was she when she died?
She was five years old. Yeah, it was a horrible death. She had a very aggressive form of adult leukemia that at the time was virtually untreatable in a young child. She was rejected by St. Jude's Hospital because her case was just, at the time, they just thought it was hopeless. And that probably might not be the case today. This was the late 60s, early 70s when this was happening.
Right. Wow. That's powerful stuff. I mean, that whole scene you just described in the classroom, it just blows you away when you hear stuff like that. I mean, the way you said that. I mean, you're a very strong-willed person. Are you like that even today?
Strong-willed? Yes, I'm very strong-willed.
I mean, I can hear it in your voice. You have a very commanding voice. It's sort of like I can sense that about you, that you are like that. You're very much in control of your life. I mean, you don't seem to have a lot of, you can't be one of these people who keep secrets. You've got to be one of these people who just, your life is an open book.
Well, you know, I kind of do feel that way. I kind of feel like and I'm not complaining. I can't stand it when the children of celebrities complain about the stuff that was really a blessing, because the majority of what happened as a result of her fame was a blessing. But we didn't really have a lot of privacy, and we weren't about cultivating a lot of privacy. She was a very public, eccentric celebrity, and that's how I was raised. And so, yeah, I was also taught you're only as sick as your secrets, which is, a famous quote that I didn't write, but I think
I've heard that.
True.
I've heard that, and I've had secrets, you know, and they have. I can tell you firsthand that it is true that having the secrets is worse than actually coming. I mean, I've come out to other people and told them things that they were very, very difficult to tell them, and you always feel so great afterwards, and then you go that whole day after thinking, did I do the right thing?
You're right. What did I do?
What have I done? Have I done something I can never repair?
Well, you know, I think it's about being vulnerable.
I'm one of those people who don't want people to think any differently of me. I want to be thought of in a good way. Don't we all want to be thought of in a good way?
We do, but, you know, and Eric Shaw Quinn, who I do the radio show with, who's a very talented, very wise writer, has said, though, we don't want to put ourselves in a situation where we make somebody like us for a version of ourselves that's not actually us.
Exactly.
The real version, they'll leave. You know, or if we make somebody fall in love with us or encourage someone to fall in love with us by pretending to be someone that we're not.
That's a good point. That's a very, very good point, because so many people try to mold themselves. And I mean, you meet people in your life you really, really like being around. And if they don't accept you for who you are, maybe you change yourself a little bit just to be able to, that they'll like you more. But is that really worth it? You know, is it really what you want to do? You're almost like selling yourself out.
Right. And, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, that is so... Boy, our conversation has really branched off.
I know.
we're not even talking about the book anymore, which is what we should be talking about. But, I mean, you're one of those people that when you start talking to you, I realize how intelligent you are and how easy you are to talk to. And that's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
But you're right. I mean, how many books have you written now? This is number what?
This is number six.
Number six. So Where do these ideas come from? Well, tell me where the idea for Heaven's Rise come from. Did you dream it? Did you read about it in the newspaper? And did an idea come to you as a result of that, or where? Where did it come from?
Well, you know, really, there were two births for this novel. There was the beginning of this idea that I was going to write about riverboat pilots in New Orleans, and that was the pre-supernatural idea. And then there was the idea of the mind control elements in the book. And the first came about from a dinner party that I attended here in L.A.
Right.
with another New Orleanian, where we discovered that nobody except for us had ever heard of the Bright Field accident, which happened in New Orleans in about 1997. And a very large, I believe it was a cargo container ship, lost engine power as it was rounding the bend in the Mississippi River right at the foot of Canal Street, which is right there. You know, it's the heart of the city.
Right.
And it crashed into the Riverwalk shopping mall. And luckily, it wasn't more devastating than it was. I actually don't think anybody died, but I should check that. If it was,
right.
The death toll was very small,
mm-hmm.
Considering how big the ship was and that it was literally out of control. And so we were telling the story, and we were talking about how, you know, we had friends who tried to drive over the Mississippi River Bridge to get a look down at the ship where it had sort of speared the side of the shopping mall. And, whatever. And at this point, I was trolling around for a new idea. I got home a few days later, and I turned on TiVo to see what it had automatically recorded for me, and it had recorded a special about the Bright Field accident. And I went, whoa, all right. And so
isn't that amazing?
Kind of right, as a sign from the universe type thing.
So this is what I should write about. Somebody's telling me to write about this.
Right, exactly.
Are you a religious person? I know your mother has been, you know, more so religious in her books lately. I mean, Jesus and, you know, religion. And I think that's great. I mean, she's writing what she wants to write.
Right. You know, I think that I am, I believe in something. I am a spiritual person. I believe that there is something bigger than me. I hover on the line between agnostic and believer. I don't identify with the Christian faith. I don't believe in the resurrection
right.
as anything other than a metaphor, and I think it's possible to practice a version of Christian belief that does accept the resurrection as metaphor and not fact. But I'm not really. I would say I probably tilt more in the Eastern direction, the sort of the Buddhist and traditions. But I know I am a bit of a theist. I do believe there is a sort of governing spiritual force to the universe that carries us along to places that we don't want to go and that we do want to go. I think the idea of trying to explain the entire universe in terms of an entirely benevolent God doesn't seem to me to be a worthwhile pursuit. You know, I don't. That's not the evidence that I see before me.
Now, there's a lot of snakes in this book. What,
yes.
What's with the snakes? I mean, I'm sure you've been
snakes.
Asked that before.
I hate snakes. You know, listen. You know, that second birth I was talking about for the book, when it began to become a supernatural idea.
Yeah.
What came from what my early reaction? We moved to Louisiana when I was 10 years old from the Bay Area.
Right.
And there was just so much nature. There was so much water. There was so much, like, the barrier between land and water and ocean and river, all of it was so vague, and the environment was so different, and I remember being very afraid of that boundarylessness, and so the snakes in the story sort of embody that. You know, they're the interlopers that can move sort of easily back and forth between, you know, urban and swamp. And so I did use one to terrifying effect, but I do have to say that the snake is almost a victim as well. I don't know if you've gotten to that part yet, but this isn't a book about killer snakes. You know, it's more about there's a moment in which a human uses a snake in a very malevolent way.
I remember there was an episode of The X-Files about snakes one time. I have never forgotten this episode since I saw it. It totally, totally, totally freaked me out.
Oh, no. What was the episode you have to tell?
I think it was about a snake eating people. And, you know, and it was really quite horrifying.
Yeah.
And to this day, I almost tremble when I think about the episode because it was so dramatic for me to watch it. I didn't know what was coming. It had something to do with a teacher who turned into a snake and was eating people, and it was so out there and so different from anything they'd ever shown before, and yet it was hard to turn away from it. You couldn't stop watching it.
Yeah.
It's like watching, you see a car wreck. It's hard to turn away from that, even though you know there's people, there may be people getting hurt, somebody may be getting killed, whatever. It's hard to turn away from it because you're so curious.
Mm-hmm.
to see what's and oh my God, that episode, just when I think about it, I in my mind I just get almost terrified.
Right. Yeah.
So I have this fear of snakes too, and you know, it's just so I know what you're going through with the snakes, but I mean I just found it interesting online that so many people mentioned the snakes of this book, so I was just curious where it had come from.
Yeah, it's so funny. I haven't read any of the reviews online, so it's like you're giving me little teasing glimpses of
online. By the way, David, shut up. Don't tell me about
this. Well, okay, so they're all reacting to the snake. All right, good. Just, you know, so
what do you watch on TV? I mean, what do you like to watch on TV?
I have to tell you, I made a commitment this TV season. I was so sick of falling in love with shows that got canceled that I'm not really tuning into many of the new shows until I get, you know, they become strongly recommended by friends or they get legs and traction.
Right.
I become very devoted to a lot of cable shows. I'm a big Game of Thrones fan. I think
Me too.
It's fascinating what they're doing, adapting novels into series, and I think that, you know, as we all say, as Eric says on our show, you know, novelists need to be more involved in television, that they have the sense on how to tell a long-term story. I think a lot of TV writers don't, to be frank. I think they sell short pitches and expect them to last for seasons. I love a lot of British crime dramas. I love Luther with Idris Elba.
Oh, Luther, yeah.
One of the most frightening but also well-done crime shows to come down the pike in a while. You know, a lot of the shows, again, that I love aren't really around anymore. Damages is still around, but
I love
it's
that
kind of
show.
It broke my heart when they downsized it for DirecTV. I could tell that the budget had been slashed. And
I still enjoyed that season, though. For some reason,
well,
season
three was, I thought, their best season, and the final moment of season three is one of the best moments of television. Very quiet, understated moment between Rose Byrne and Glenn Close, and that I just thought was fantastic.
It was fantastic. There was something between them that made it so much fun to watch. You're like, oh, are they going to scratch each other's eyes out? What's going to happen with these two?
Right.
You just don't know what's going to happen between them. And Breaking Bad, which is, oh my God, that show is the most, I've never seen anything as good as that, I don't think.
I watched a season of Breaking Bad, and I quite enjoyed it, but it was the third season, and then I started with the fourth, and I thought, oh my God, I don't know if I could do this. It was just so grim. But, you know,
it is grim.
You know, and I don't fault it for that. It was one of those things where I didn't quite have the mettle for it.
Well, you knew it wasn't going to end happily, but it was just one of those things that I couldn't stop watching it. I just couldn't stop. I got hooked. It was like, it was worse than eating peanuts. It was like, mm-hmm. like eating half a peanut. You know, I couldn't stop it. I just couldn't, no matter what I tried, I couldn't stop it. So,
right, exactly.
So how much time do you devote to writing now? I mean, you're, obviously, this book's out now, but are you writing another book now, or do you take time off?
You know, I'm a third. I'm always trying to avoid taking time off because I'll take too much time off. I'm a third of the way through another supernatural thriller set in the Deep South, and that's pretty much all I can say about it currently. I do a lot of writing for the Dinner Party Show. We have about 45 minutes of sketches that are included in each two-hour show. They're broken up in.
Now, how often is a new show aired?
Well, we'll be airing new shows Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific at thedinnerpartyshow.com. While I'm on the road, I'll actually be calling in via Skype, and Eric and I will be recording sort of special, kind of mostly talk podcasts. When on November 17th, we'll be back to our regular format, which is a two-hour live show with these skits woven in, and they're very sort of like SNL Weekend Update. We have special correspondents who are characters that Eric and I play, and those are all scripted and edited and pre-recorded, and they give the show a kind of structure as it moves along.
Besides what you talked about earlier, did you have a relatively happy childhood?
I think so. I wasn't the most grateful child in the world, and I think I earned gratitude later in life about the enormous privileges that I was granted and how remarkable my upbringing was. But I think at the time I could have my moments of temper tantrum and depression, as any sort of adolescent could. And I have to say, a large impetus behind writing The Heavens Rise is I wanted to address New Orleans from a different perspective. I love my first book. I think it's wild and crazy and youthful and fun, but it is a very harsh and unforgiving perspective on a lot of communities in New Orleans, and I wasn't interested in going back to that again. I wanted, you know, this is the joke I always make, but I wanted to tell a kinder, gentler story about New Orleans, and so naturally, because I'm a writer, it turned out to be a horror novel. But that was the horrors in New Orleans are not necessarily communities, ostracizing people as it was in A Density of Souls. They're supernatural horrors. They're kind of
Your horror novels are not like Stephen King horror novels. They're a different kind of horror novels, aren't they?
I don't know. I think this is the first one that could be described as a horror novel, and I think there's some similarities to Stephen King. I think in his later books, at least, Stephen King combines some really sort of sensitive characterizations and depictions of small-town life woven in with the horror, so it wasn't all one thing and it wasn't all the other. And I think that's something that's actually there in The Heavens Rise. And for some people, it's a problem. Some people, they think, I saw one critic said, well, the characters are so believable, you have trouble believing the unbelievable conclusion. I said, it's a supernatural thriller,
It's not supposed to have a believable. It's like those Paranormal Activity movies. Like, nothing happens till the very end anyway. So.
Right, exactly. Right.
Maybe you have one scare, and then the rest is boring. It's like, well, nothing else is happening. What are they? So we're going 90 minutes without anything happening, and 5 minutes, something happens,
And my response is, the thing that can happen before is you can actually get to know and care about the characters who are involved. And I think with a lot of just hard horror, they don't want you to care about the characters too much because they're just setting them up to be slaughtered, and that's not really my MO in this book.
And the other thing with Stephen King is when you read Stephen King's books, suddenly you'll read a character and you're like, I know somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know somebody in real life who's like that. So
right.
He gets right into your familiarity. It makes you feel like it's familiar territory because you've met somebody like that. So that,
right.
And that's a good trick of writing. I mean, to make a character that seems, but make a character believable, completely believable. It's not an
absolutely.
Easy thing to do. I mean, they can be very cardboardish. After a while, some of these characters that have a series, after a while they just become nothing anymore. It's like,
right.
I don't even feel like I know them anymore. I need to feel what they're feeling. I need to go through what they're going through.
Right, absolutely.
And, so much of fiction is based, it has stuff that's real in it, whether it's a real location or real, you're going on a sightseeing tour of the city, and some of them, whatever, but it also seems to be real. So will you keep doing books like this, or will you ever do something completely different?
Well, what this book has taught me is that I'll never rule anything out, and I'll never say never. I said I'd never do Supernatural, and I would never write a book set in New Orleans again, and I've done both. So, no promises. That's what I have
to say. So we can't trust you.
You really can't trust me to do anything but write.
You're such
I can only be trusted to write.
I don't know why, but for some reason, just talking to you, I feel good things about you. I feel like you're a good person.
You.
And I don't normally... I felt that way when we were emailing back and forth before we did the interview. But, I mean, some authors, you can't tell where they're going to because you'll ask them a question, they'll get real funny with their response. But you're a very open person. You must be
thank you.
You must be a very affectionate person, too. I don't know why I say that. I don't know where this is all coming from.
I try.
Thing with me is when I start talking to somebody that I really feel... Some connection with. I don't know what connection we have other than I've never spoken to you before in my life. People out there are saying, oh, you probably talked to him before. I haven't. I've never spoken to you before.
Right.
And yet I feel a kind of a connection with you because I admire the way you live your life.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I don't know where all this is coming. I don't usually do this with authors, but it's very nice. But I should mention that The Heavens Rise is out from Gallery Books. I don't think I mentioned Gallery Books.
Right.
And its cover is really cool, though. I love to put my hand over the cover and just feel it. It's like velvet, almost.
It is. It's really... I'm doing the same thing right now.
Now, you live somewhere in California?
I do. I live in West Hollywood.
West Hollywood. So have any of your books been... Are they going to be turned into movies, or have they been movies?
They have not been turned into movies. There's more and stronger interest in this one than any of the previous books.
I wonder why that is.
I'm optimistic. I think it's the supernatural elements. I think it's also the strong female character of Nikki DeLongpre, sort of supernaturally gifted young woman, is attractive to Hollywood right now. And it has a feel to it that a lot of the producers are seeing is similar to the YA successes like Hunger Games and Twilight. I would not compare it to Twilight, but, it has some of those elements in there. So.
Twilight, it's amazing how much Twilight is bashed, even though it's been so popular. I mean, people still bash it, and it's like... Well, the woman's just writing what she wants to write. Leave her alone, If you don't like it, go on to the next book.
Right, yeah.
Did you read the Twilight books?
I did not read the Twilight books. My good friend Bill Condon directed the last two movies, and I have great respect for him. Yeah, and he, you know, apparently did a great job. So he's a great director, and he has a movie coming out currently called The Fifth Estate, which I believe came out this weekend.
I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's about Julian Assange. It's a DreamWorks movie about him, and Bill directed that movie, and he's very talented.
That's really cool. So you have a lot of friends out there on the West Coast.
Yeah, I've been out here about 11 years now, so I have a little community that I really love.
Now, do you still have friends in New Orleans?
I do. I do have friends in New Orleans.
So that must have been hard to leave when you had all those friends there.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't hard at all.
No, I was really, really eager to come out here.
So it was really hard
to live in California.
You obviously love to write. So
yeah,
your life is not.
I love California. I was born out here. I was born in Northern California, and I love the climate. I love the environment. I think it's a beautiful place to live, and I love it. And I dreamed of moving out here, and I did. So.
You're living your dream, and I really admire you for some reason without even knowing a lot about you.
Well, thank you very much.
I don't know where this is all coming from. I don't usually get this involved with an author. I usually just have the interview and then we hang up and I never hear from them again. So, but I just love the way you speak and talk and your. But anyway. We have to let you go at some point, unfortunately. I could talk to you all night. You're one of those people that I feel like I could tell my whole life story to.
Well, thank you. Yeah, unfortunately, as I was telling you, this is my last day at home before I leave on the book tour, which starts tomorrow. So
where will you head on the book tour? Are you going to New York?
Yeah, we're going to New York. We're going to Minneapolis, Philadelphia. The entire schedule is
where in Philadelphia?
We'll be in I'll be at Giovanni's room.
Oh, Giovanni's room, okay.
Yeah, the schedule is at ChristopherRiceBooks.com, and it's under events and tour schedule on the
top banner. Do you get a lot of fans that show up at these things?
Yeah, I do. I'm very blessed.
See, but you're very unusual. That's what people like. They know they're going to get something unusual when you come to visit.
Yeah, totally.
And you like that. So
always, yeah.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate you doing this for me. And the book again The book again is called The Heaven's Rise. It's out from Gallery Books. We've been talking to Christopher Rice. And this has been Dave's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk. Brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, Baldacci.